Welcome to Ballistic Radio. Join us as we discuss hard-won self-defense lessons, as well as the information you need to survive a violent encounter. Listen as armed professionals, industry experts, and gunfight survivors help answer all your firearms and self-defense questions while exploring your rights and responsibilities as an armed citizen. Ballistic Radio, just the facts. And now, here's your host, John Johnston.
Welcome to Ballistic Radio. I'm your host, John Johnston. Remember, you can always listen to past shows at ballisticradio.com and get the latest behind-the-scenes info, arguments, photos, battles against derp, silliness, videos, shirtless selfies of me.
There are those.
Well,
that is not a lie.
Not the way you think, though.
Yes.
At facebook.com/ballisticradio. Co-hosting with me this evening is Matt, the Minion. Wanted to end on a down note.
Yeah, the Minion.
That's right. So anyway, it is that time again where we answer the Facebook users' questions and then do some sort of weird random Star Wars title for the podcast once it gets posted, because we just like phoning one in once a month. That's pretty much what this is.
So. Yeah.
Where am I right now? I am taking Ernest Langdon's Advanced Tactical Handgun class, or whatever he calls that thing. I'm learning how to run a gun more effectively, and hopefully I have earned the 13th Fast Coin ever awarded. Though maybe I haven't. We'll see. I give my chances 50-50. So I was unable to perform last time. It happens to everyone, right? And then the Minion is getting stabbed in the taint, or has just gotten done being stabbed in the taint.
That does not sound right.
Well, that's what happens at ECQC. See, Joe walked out of the booth while we're recording this, so he won't even know that I said this, and unless he listens to this particular second of airtime, he won't be able to catch it either. Wow, he's looking at me. He just walked back in, and now he's looking at me like, what did you say?
What did you do?
Well, he's really looking at me, too.
Richard, what'd you do?
I know, right? Just a reminder, this segment brought to you by Wilson Combat. Wilson Combat, makers of the finest custom 1911s, ARs, and scatterguns since 1977. Legacy of quality, innovation, and service. Learn more about their firearms and accessories at www.wilsoncombat.com. And for those that don't know, ECQC would be Craig Douglas's Extreme Close Quarter Concepts class. And from my personal experience, the Minion's going to be rather worn down by the end of Sunday, both mentally and physically. Kind of like he spent a weekend in the basement again.
Mm-hmm.
Wait, what? Anyway, let's just get to people's questions. This is probably a good point to get serious.
Yeah, well, as serious as we can get.
Right.
All right, let's get right into it. The first one is from Hank Fannert. What do you think about the fallout from the EOTech mess will be? Or what do you think the fallout from the EOTech mess will be?
Huh. For those that do not know, recently, United States Special Operations Command issued a warning, pretty much, a service warning, and the exact term is escaping me. U.S. SOCOM issues safety of use message for EOTech enhanced combat optical sights. And essentially what the issue is that, number one, EOTech has been claiming for years that their optics are parallax free, which is not true, number one. Number two, there is an extreme shift in 4-6 MOA shift and where you've zeroed it out versus where it's going to hit at extreme ends of the temperature scale, which for a normal everyday user probably doesn't matter, but for the people actually going out and shooting it or using it to shoot bad guys in the face, it certainly matters a lot. Also, too, their adjustments are not actual MOA increments. They're close to MOA increments. But essentially what's been going on is EOTech has been lying by omission or outright lying about what their product is capable of or what it will or will not do at certain ends of the scale. The other thing, too, this is in addition to observed by many people, durability issues. So I posted this link on the Facebook page to the article that came out. And then right after that, I shared a post from one of my friends who is in a tip of the spear type unit that actually issues EOTechs. And he had 2 out of 20 go down bad, where like lenses separated from the inside of the housing and the optic will not work, period. So this is a pretty common occurrence that EOTechs have issues, and apparently they have bigger issues than people thought. So I think the fallout from this, number one, will be they're about to lose all of their government contracts. I would be willing to bet money on that. They're actually going to be paying a $26 million settlement to probably the government. They've not said who, but they issued a message to their stockholders that they were getting ready to do that, you know, as they're required to by law as part of the SEC, I want to say it was. But anyway, so yeah, EOTechs suck and have for a while, but now it's official, is pretty much it. So the fallout is going to be a lot of used EOTechs on the market for cheap and probably less use in government, you know, government applications. You know, and maybe they'll get stuff fixed and whatever, but right now it's not looking too good for them. So, yeah, anyway. Next question, which I believe is related to this.
Yes, it ties in. Andrew Russ wants to know, what is the better Red Dot Aimpoint or EOTech?
Huh. Well, I'll compare and contrast. We've got one, the Aimpoint, that has a very long battery life that is known for extreme durability. Is known for being able to hold zero after being abused severely, both physically and through temperature cycling and climate, you know, different operating climates. That and you can leave it on. I mean, the battery life on those is measured in years left on. So we've got that, or we've got the EOTech, which has durability issues, has battery issues, has operating issues, has apparently adjustment issues. I will say this, I like the reticle better. So I think that having that big circle around the center dot is useful for finding the center dot quickly. You can also do some cool things with, you know, use zero at 50, use the bottom edge of the circle for a 7 yard zero. You know, so there are positives about it. It's just when you look at the positives compared to the negatives. Oh, the other thing too, the EOTech has an auto off feature, which I do not like, because if I leave my optic on, I want it to stay on generally. You know, I'd say at this point that the people that are arguing the EOTech even compares to the Aimpoint are either very emotionally attached to EOTech, work for EOTech and L3, or have not been paying attention. You know, so personally, if it were me, I would not put an EOTech on one of my serious use guns for any amount of money in the world. You know, that's where I'm at right now. So yeah. What else, Minion? We got about 2 minutes left in this segment.
All right, we'll go ahead and let's do this one. Glenn Doss wants to know, he said, John, give a complete rundown of your EDC.
Everyday carry.
Yes, everyday carry. And he actually did spell that out. How often does it change? And he also wants to know what my EDC is.
Huh, everyday carry. Wait, you carry?
Yeah.
Weird. I usually am carrying a service pistol, full-size service pistol. Lately has been a Glock, sometimes Wilson Combat 1911, depending on what I'm doing that day. You know, usually weapon-mounted light. I usually have a reload. I have a fixed-blade knife. I usually have spray, so an OC spray. And I usually have a second gun, which is generally a Glock 42 in my pocket. You know, so that's about what I carry. You know, and I do that for my personal reason. I'm not saying everyone else has to go out and do that. I think the spray is a really good idea for most people, and they don't really acknowledge that. How about you, Minion?
Me? I guess I usually carry the Glock 43 right now in a Dark Star Gear appendix holster. And usually I just have like a pocket knife and carry a small flashlight attached to my pocket somewhere. And I usually have a reload for that Glock 43.
Well, there you go. Oh, yeah, I've got a light on my keychain, too. I forgot. So, I mean, I have an administrative light, and then I have the weapon-mounted light for if I need to shoot. We'll get into that a little later, though, just because there was someone asking about night sights versus other sights and my thoughts on weapon-mounted lights and all that. But I think we got to go to break. We don't have time for another one. Anyway, we're doing our Facebook user question show, and you're listening to Ballistic Radio. Welcome back to Ballistic Radio. I think we're up out of the This segment brought to you by Dark Star Gear. Whether you know the color of the boathouse at Hereford, or only know the color of your mom's basement and your Cheeto-stained socks, Dark Star Gear has a solution your gear-carrying needs. Check out their clip-on holster for small semi-autos and revolvers, or their highly adjustable full-size AIWB holster. They even have a belt-wrapped sheath for when you need to shank a fool, made for the popular fixed-blade centerline knives currently available. They really tie your EDC together, like that one rug I used to have. Check out the holsters used by myself and many of the show's guests, but not Jake from last week, because he still sucks even though he's not here. We even let the minion have one.
I actually have two.
Wow. Find out more at darkstargear.com. Meow.
It's a good thing that you're friends with him.
Well, yes. It's a good thing that it's a silly place here.
Yes.
Like Camelot.
Exactly.
Where are my coconuts? I want to go for a ride. So we're doing the Facebook user question show, and we're not live right now, too, which means that I'm a little bit more silly for some reason, I've noticed, when we record the show, and I don't know if that's a psychological thing or because we record earlier than I like to be moving. That could be it. But anyway, more questions, shopkeeper.
More.
Bring me a horse.
How about a question?
You know, that's the second time I've made that reference.
I know.
Do you remember what movie it's from?
I don't.
Oh, wait, I didn't tell you last time.
You never told me what it was last time.
This is homework here.
So
wait, here's the thing. Next time I ask you this on air, if you don't know the answer, I'm firing you.
No. Well, or I should bring you a horse.
I thought you were going to take the S out of there, and it was about to get really interesting. Anyway.
Anyway, next question. When a person...
Then we just need blow, and we could be just like Chris Costa.
Yay.
Wow.
Man, I just shot questions.
Did you delete them?
No, thankfully.
Okay.
I just shut the window. Anyways, next question from Derek Brenneman.
I kind of just want to mess with you more to see if I can make you lose the questions again.
That would not be good, but...
All right, go ahead.
Not touching anything. When a person is just beginning instructor-led training, would you recommend starting with a local-level instructor to get his or her feet wet and the basics down, or a national-level instructor to avoid... the higher probability of getting poorly researched information.
Well, so here's the thing about that. I think the main problem facing most of the people that start out with training is not really clearly identifying what it is they want to learn or need to learn, better yet. I'm not aware. Well, that's not true. There are some national level instructors that are teaching basic level classes, but... those are kind of few and far between. And honestly, for the amount of instruction that would be good for a person to get when they were first starting out, it might be cost prohibitive to go to someone that deserves and earns, you know, $400-$500 a weekend per person for a class. The thing is understanding the context of what you're trying to teach and also, too, identifying who is best able to teach that to you. So if you're trying to learn basic safety and basic firearms handling and manipulations, then yeah, there are plenty of local level instructors that do a good job of that. You do not need to go out and learn how to breach structures or clear rooms or many other things that I can think of when you are first, you know, starting out. And honestly, if you want to go learn those things at some point, you're doing that more out of a quest for knowledge and an enjoyment of the subject than you are for most practical needs, at least, you know, for the most part. you know, when you're at a lower level, one of the problems is that you are not able to separate what you are learning into, okay, here's what's applicable to me in a day-to-day, and here's what's applicable to me in the fantasy gun camp scenario that I have. So, you know, that's it, as far as that goes. Was that an answer, or did I just talk for a couple minutes and not say anything?
Because
I do that sometimes.
Maybe a little bit of both.
Okay. So, yes, if you can find a reputable local instructor, thank you, Joe. You should just say it over air. You don't need to say it in my headphones. Just next time, if you have something to say, say it so everyone can hear. It's like bringing enough gum for the class. So, yes, finding a reputable local-level instructor is a good idea, probably cheaper. You probably have more of an opportunity for mentorship in that scenario. That's not to say don't go and take a national-level instructor's class, you know, but you don't want to be the guy that shows up to class that holds the class back, if that makes sense. Yeah.
Yeah.
Sure.
I believe so. Our next question is from Steve Gersheim. He says, what tactical benefits does a shotgun offer over a carbine? Semi-auto versus pump.
Tactical benefits.
Tactical.
That's an interesting way to use tactical. I'll go, what capabilities does a shotgun offer over a carbine? Let's look at what is likely versus what a lot of people think of. So one of the things that people talk about with shotguns is a limited range and a limited capacity. And I would argue that when we look at the typical self-defense shootings that occur for civilians in the United States, and I'm tailoring this answer towards a civilian application, military, completely different thing, and I'm not discussing that right now. Law enforcement is probably a different thing too. But for civilians, you know, talking about long gun use, most long gun use happens within handgun range, number one. So the range thing is kind of taken out of the equation a little bit. And the other thing, too, is that with good buckshot like the Federal Flight Control, your range where you can make pretty decent shots is much greater than you would expect. You know, I've patterned the number one and the double lot federal stuff out to 25 yards, and you've got pretty much 100% accountability at 25 yards for all of your pellets. You don't really start dropping things off the target until you get closer to 50 yards, and even then, it's not by much. I could make a strong argument that the shotgun with that, you know, with buckshot, if you pattern it and know what it's going to do, is a 50-yard weapon. So when we're looking at across-the-room distances, which is what in our house is, what does the carbine offer us? Well, the carbine offers us more rounds. But does it really? So if you look at what most of the carbine guys are teaching for a non-standard response, NSR drill, which is how many rounds do you fire at someone, you know, as a general rule of thumb, and depending on where you go, it's anywhere between 3 to 7. So if you're expending 3 to 7 rounds on each target that you come across, and your magazine holds 28 to 30 rounds, or maybe 20, depending, how many servings of ammunition do you have? You want to do math real quick, Minion? I just wanted to mess with you. Anyway, how many servings do you have? You know, you've got 6, 7, 5, depending, which starts to kind of fall in the line with where a shotgun's at. And with a shotgun, and I hate to say this because I don't believe in sure things, but I have been unable to find any instance occurring in the continental United States where someone took more than 2 12-gauge defensive loads, you know, double aught buck, number one, something like that, to the torso and continued to fight. And honestly, the number I can find that went over 1 was small. And by small, I mean under 10. And this is out of hundreds of instances that I've been able to find. So when we look at the close-range effectiveness of a shotgun, it works pretty good. I can say that with as much confidence as we can have in what a bullet will do, and, you know, they do funny things, if you make a good hit with a shotgun, in most circumstances, that will probably fix the problem. So the tactical advantages, you've got a close-range weapon, you know, in my house, I'm not taking a very long shot. So we've got something that I know what the longest distance is going to be. I know that it's effective at that distance. Not too worried about capacity because I've just told you why I'm not worried about capacity. The over-penetration thing, while carbines do penetrate a little bit less through interior structure walls, they still penetrate. So I'm really leaning towards the shotgun most days. As far as pump versus semi-auto, I think that the Beretta 1301 is probably the best shotgun ever made. I'm coming up on 1,500 rounds through it, and I've not had a single malfunction yet. I have caused malfunctions in pump action guns. So from a reliability standpoint, the semi-auto has been more reliable for me. So yeah, that's where I'm at. Anyway, we got to go to break. We're doing your questions today, and right now you're listening to Ballistic Radio. TopGunSupply.com is your web source for fine firearms parts and accessories. True Products Specialists, aw man, committed to delivering the highest level of customer support to you. They carry top name brands including Ed Brown, Wilson Combat, Les Bear, Sig Sauer, and many more, as well as premium AR pattern rifles. Whether you are looking to protect yourself, are a first-time gun buyer, or a competitive shooter, TopGunSupply.com can satisfy your firearms needs. TopGunSupply.com, your premier source for SIG parts and accessories. So, we're giving more stuff away with TopGunSupply.com.
Yes, we are.
What are we giving away?
This time it is a Lucas Oil product package, which includes contact cleaner, CLP, both in liquid and aerosol form, a gun oil needler, a tube of gun grease, and a cleaning cloth.
And it's not Crisco.
No, it's not.
Hey! the Lucas stuff works great. I've used it in the past. I had no issues with it. And hey, free stuff. If you want to get in on that, go to our Facebook page and click the giveaways tab at the top of the page. And make sure you can get a decent amount of entries there. There's ways to get more than one.
Yep.
So, and your chances are good that you might win something. So anyway.
Right back to the questions.
I guess.
Yeah, we have to.
That's all right.
I suppose. Eric Fiola, he says, we all know your thoughts on a weapon-mounted light, but do you think that night sights are a must as well? If so, what brand?
So this is something that I have been vacillating back and forth between lately. And number one, my thoughts on a weapon-mounted light, I like to have one. I carry one. I like how the gun works a little bit better with one mounted. I like that I've got a standoff device, and I like that I can shoot the gun faster. And I also like that I have a light attached to my gun in case it is dark out and I can shoot stuff. I live in the middle of nowhere. There's not really much ambient light. I've actually used my weapon mounted light to shoot stuff in my yard before. So I'm a fan of having those, but is it necessary? Probably not. Now, as far as night sights go, night sights are usable in a very small window of lighting conditions. One of them is, right at dusk or dawn, where you've got enough light to identify a target, but you don't have enough to see your sights. There's not enough light to create an outline. Number one. The other one that not many people think of is when you are in a dark environment shooting into a lit environment. And that happens more than people think. If you remove the slide from your gun and just, if you've got an extra gun that has night sights on it, take the slide off the gun, take everything out of it, put that in your bag or whatever, and just, you can actually play around with the lighting conditions in your home and see where night sights are useful or are not useful. You can play around with it in your office, assuming that your office is not going to be weirded out by you having a slide in your hand. You can play around in the car. Probably don't want to do it in public. That might be a little weird, but... Wait, what are we talking about? Oh, yeah, slides. So anyway, and do it that way, too, so you're not muzzling anything. That'd probably be good. But, are they necessary? Most of the time, not. But when you need them, you really need them bad. I generally prefer the Trigicon HDs or the Ameriglows. The Ameriglows, I'll run a ProGlow front and a Pro Operator rear. But my default is the Trigicon HDs. Lately, though, I have been using a fiber optic front with a either adjustable all-black rear or non-adjustable all-black rear, and I have been able to get a bit more precision out of that setup. and maybe a bit more precision at speed, which has been interesting to me. But I think I've been doing some other things a little bit differently too. So I think my preferred setup, once it becomes available, is going to be a set of fiber optics on top, and then the Steiner E Optics S Ball, which is a weapon mounted light that has a green laser in a very small package, about the size of an X300, as opposed to the X400 that's got the laser module hanging underneath the light. And that way I'll have all my bases covered. That's probably the plan. We'll see if I actually do that or not. But anyway, there we go.
All right. Next one is from James Tolet. He says, why do stupid people still insist that a revolver is more reliable than a modern semi-auto?
Lack of experience. I mean, so the thing about revolvers, I've noticed not many people shoot them a lot. Generally because the revolvers they have are small and they're not fun to shoot. I have seen quite a few revolvers break, and the thing is, when they have a malfunction that requires tools and a gunsmith. So they are certainly not more reliable. They are reliable in a different way. Are you as likely to see minor malfunctions like, failure to eject or a failure to feed? No. Is it as easy to fix the malfunctions when you see them? Uh-uh. Not at all. The only thing that I see revolvers is really good for these days is if you're going to pocket carry something. They seem to hold up a little better in pockets than some other guns do. But, honestly, I'm carrying a G42 in my pocket, and I've yet to have a problem with it. But, I'm still experimenting with that. Maybe they'll crop up later. I don't know. But, revolvers break. Don't think they don't. And when they do, it's generally bad news bears. So, anyway.
All right. The next one we have is from Joe Hun. It says, particularly with handguns, what are the benefits of using both eyes as opposed to closing one while engaging the target? Does one over the other improve accuracy, or does it mainly have to do with situational awareness?
Well, generally, you can get a crisper sight picture if you are closing one eye. So for extreme distances, I have experimented around with that. And, it works okay. I shoot with both eyes open. I have found it to be quicker. I just have had better luck with it. And honestly, that's how I've trained myself to shoot. It really depends on how your eyes work. Something that a lot of people don't seem to realize is that we're all different. And some of us can see things differently than other people can. And, the only way you're going to see your sights at all is if you close one eye, then okay, close one eye. If you can shoot comfortably with both eyes open, then do that. I'm not really going to, ding someone either way. Good example. Mike Pannone only has one eye, and he seems to shoot just fine. So it's not like you're really... It is not necessarily a major limit if you do not shoot both eyes open. So, was that a good answer? That was a politic answer, right?
Yeah, so what you're kind of saying is whatever works for you?
Well, maybe. So that's a dangerous, yes, but that's a dangerous path to fall down because some of the things that people think works for them are really dumb. So what I will say is if you are able to shoot, some standards that are measurable and are common, and you've got something to compare yourself to, and you can shoot that well the way that you're shooting now as far as that particular thing goes, then okay. Whatever. Some people have extreme eye dominance issues. Some people have vague eye dominance issues, which is even worse, where one eye is not really dominant over the other. I mean, there are reasons I can think of that you would shoot one eye closed.
All right. Next one we have here is from Francisco Sanchez. He says, what has been the most reliable semi-auto SBR, ammo, and suppressor combo you have used in any caliber?
I've had a lot of luck with my 11.5-inch Knights armament with an M4-2000, AAC M4-2000 suppressor. I can't really think of any issues I've had with that gun off the top of my head. It pretty much will eat anything that I shoot through it. I know a lot of people like piston guns for suppressed SBRs, I guess, I've not, I've not really ever felt the need to go that way. I mean, maybe if I went full auto too and was shooting a lot of that, it'd make more sense for me. But, you know, personally, with what I've used, I've had a lot of luck with that. You know, the BCM SBRs are good too, and they are certainly cheaper than the Knights. You know, the Daniel Defense Mark 18 wouldn't be a bad option either. So, let's see. We got to go to break here, then we've got one segment left of your questions. Anyway, you're listening to Ballistic Radio. Welcome back to Ballistic Radio. This segment brought to you by Pac-Strike Steel Target Systems, makers of the quarter-scale steel target and the Archer target stand, which are literally the best steel targets and target stands I've ever used. Hit their steel targets with more than 50,000 rounds of rifle and pistol ammunition, as well as shotgun stuff, without a single problem. For more information, visit them at tacstrike.com. So, we are answering your questions on the show today. We got a couple more left. We're in our final segment here. I am sad to know that the show is coming to an end yet again, but we'll be back next week.
Yes, we will.
I feel like we should sing a song now.
No.
Okay.
Next one is from Eric Timangelo. The Vanguard series requires a shooter to reholster with two hands. There are some that say that one-handed reholstering is a crucial skill. Beyond the convenience of doing so while dry firing or during actual range time, is it really a crucial skill, say, in the context of a defensive shooting?
So one of the things I will say about the Vanguard is the way that Raven tells you to do that is actually remove the holster from your belt and holster with the gun in your hand and with the Vanguard in your other hand, you know, so that you are not muzzling yourself, not muzzling your hand. That is the safe way to do that and the way they tell you to do that. So I just wanted to be clear when he says requires two hands to reholster. No, it requires you removing it from your belt and reholstering that way. How crucial is that? Well, if you are a police officer effecting arrests, the ability to holster one-handed is pretty important. If you are a civilian and you have a defensive gun use, you do not want to have the gun in your hand when the police show up. Period. You know, that's if you're holding someone at gunpoint, you know. Man, I don't want to be the dude with a gun in my hand when the cops show up. I do not. So if you are able to reholster safely with one hand, sure, you could put the gun on the ground and stand on it. A lot of people do not really consider what kind of frame of mind they're going to be in when they do something like that. We had a case here where a plainclothes Cincinnati police officer, shot a suspect in a utility truck, and there's video of this, so you can actually see it happen. And my understanding is he made a pretty spectacular headshot that was readily apparent was effective. And you can see him just kind of stop and go, huh? And he actually puts the gun on the ground and just takes a step away from it. Now, is that what they taught him to do? No. But good on him for realizing that he probably wasn't going to be able to safely reholster his gun in that instant. That's fine. You know, if you have made sure that there are no other threats around and the situation is under control and the police are arriving imminently, then yeah, you know, that's put the gun down. So being able to reholster one-handed, yes, it's a good thing to be able to do, but if you can't do it, I wouldn't say it's the end-all be-all. Especially in the context of a civilian self-defense shooting. So, just once again, my opinion for what that's worth. You didn't pay me for it, so I guess it's not worth very much.
Yeah, there you go.
Yep.
Okay, AJ Bonnie asks, how much training time should an average person have before feeling confident in protecting one's family and self in a situation where a firearm is needed?
Well, let's see. I've got about 800 hours worth of private instruction I've received in the last 3 years. I am, by most people's standard, pretty okay with a handgun. I'm probably equipped to deal with most the typical problems I would encounter. That having been said, I don't know how confident I feel about that. I mean, deep down, there's always that thought, oh, I could be better. I maybe should be better. So, you know, I don't think there is a point where you go, okay, I'm done. I've got enough training. I think that if you have the time and you have the resources, that that's something that you should constantly be striving to do, is better yourself. Now, the reverse of that. There are plenty of people that defend themselves successfully that have received no training at all. So, does someone need to be a super secret squirrel ninja type Ranger Delta Team 6 operator? No. Is that the training you should go and look for? No, probably not, not unless you're into that thing, and if you are, cool. So, you know, there's either end of the scale. The thing is that if your plan is to just suck less than the other guy does, that's not a long-term plan for surviving violent encounters. You know, planning on getting lucky is not a good thing. The other thing I've noticed too about training is that you are a lot less likely to make a poor decision with a gun in your hand if you've gone and gotten training, and that should be of more concern to most people than it is. You know, you are just as likely to make a mistake with that gun in your hand as you are to have to shoot a bad guy, maybe even more so. You know, so going out and really getting some training on understanding the laws in your location, understanding ways that you can de-escalate and avoid situations, you know, having the skills to avoid the fight in the first place are incredibly important. And that's not something that you just come up with on your own. It's really not. You know, if the bad idea fairy looked like anything other than the good idea fairy, not as many people would listen to her. You know, and the thing is, she dresses up all nice, but that doesn't mean she knows what she's talking about. And I say this a lot better when there's not FCC involved, but you're not going to improvise anything good if you need a gun. You're not, especially if you're not trained. So that's my thoughts on that. I think we got time for one more, maybe two more. We'll see.
All right. Well, let's do this one. Nick Carullo wants to know, what is the best way in which to engage a target on the passenger side of your vehicle from the driver's seat?
Driving away. That's still the best way to do that. If you need to draw and you need to shoot something out your passenger window, which is a very limited and very artificial circumstance, I'm not saying it doesn't happen, but if you need to do it, there's a couple things that need to happen. You need to draw the gun in a way that diverts the muzzle away from you as quickly as possible and indexes it somewhere safe. Somewhere safe, when you are in the driver's seat, is going to be the dashboard. Now, if you have a passenger in the passenger seat, you need to project the muzzle of the gun past them so that you are not shooting past them, and if they do something, you know, silly, like try and duck, they don't duck in front of your muzzle. The other thing that you need to do, if you're going to project past them, you probably need to make positive contact with them and apply pressure to them so that you're kind of bracing your arm against them. The reason for that is so that if they jerk forward and move and divert your muzzle from what you're aiming at, it's not as big of a diversion. I'm not saying that you're not going to see it as much, but if you've already applied positive tension to something, it is much more difficult for that something to move you than otherwise. Once again, though, driving away, or better yet, go and take a class from William Petty or Craig Douglas or Chase Jenkins or Wayne Fisher, as I stated in the video that I posted not too long ago. I am not by any means a fighting around a car guy. You know, I know the basics of it, but that is not anything close to what I would consider a subject I am really knowledgeable on. So
yes, and to clarify, when you first started answering the question as into how to engage, you said driving away. You don't mean engage while driving away, you mean disengage and drive away.
Well, never engage in the first place. Yes, we don't drive by here.
No.
So anyway,
we'll squeeze one last one in real quick, maybe. Matt Mitchell.
Phrasing.
Yeah.
Just a tip. Matt Mitchell.
Matt Mitchell Since you have really buckled down and have been consistent with your workout conditioning, what effects have you noticed on the range? Any changes in your daily active self-protection skill set?
And by the way, go check out the active self-protection page. John Currier, I don't know how to say his last name right, so that's close. Does a really good job of running that page and has a lot of useful information on there. Anyway, so what difference have I noticed? I'm more mobile. You know, I'm not really doing a lot of strength training right now, and I do notice a huge difference when I am actively strength training. But, you know, I am training for a run right now more than anything. You know, in general, though, your level of fitness determines how hard you are to kill. Strong people are harder to kill. That's, you know, a perfect example of this is Paul Sharp, who is a very beastly dude, has a brain aneurysm, doesn't notice for a couple days, and drives himself to the emergency room after a shift as a police officer, you know, after he has a brain aneurysm. And it was something that would have killed much lesser people. You know, and there's all sorts of examples like that. Mike Day getting shot 27 times over in the sandbox and killing the four dudes that shot him. That's another example of strong people are hard to kill. So whatever you are able to do, I think that's important, and honestly, it's probably a little bit more important than squeezing in one more range session or anything. You can't shoot a heart attack in the face. You can't shoot a blocked artery in the face. You can't shoot diabetes in the face. So, you know, taking care of yourself should probably be the number one goal. But anyway, it's that time. Make sure you check out our website, ballisticradio.com, like our Facebook page at facebook.com/ballisticradio. Thanks for listening, everyone. As always, be safe, and see you next time.